Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, Happy New Year. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. I'm Michelle Hanratty. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to optometrists around the country. In this episode, we'll be looking at visual fields. Although visual field tests can seem a little bit laborious and time-consuming, or even from a patient's point of view, less impressive than the more modern test of OCT, the results can be invaluable when trying to explain a patient's symptoms or detecting early disease. That's because they assess the whole visual pathway from the optic nerve head right through to the cortex. A common cause of visual field loss is glaucoma, which we've explored on the podcast before. And whilst the tests that we do routinely tend to focus on the structure of the retina, there are situations where the retina looks totally normal. When you can't get to the bottom of a patient's problem, a visual field test could reveal something that isn't working behind the eye. In this episode, we'll look at some of the possible causes of visual field defects and how to detect them. Towards the end of 2022, Docket delivered a webinar on non-glaucomatous visual fields. And it was clear from the audience questions that this was one of those areas of clinical practice where we seem slightly uncertain and don't want to be caught out. We'll be exploring all of this and covering the questions asked by fellow optometrists during the webinar with Dr. Lindsay Rowntree, Assistant Professor in Optometry at the University of Bradford.
Knowing the anatomy of how all of this fits together really helps to understand what's going on.
But first, it's important to understand visual field testing from the perspective of an optometrist in practice. To do this, I'm joined by Stephen Freeman. Stephen is an optometrist and a chief examiner for the College of Optometrists Scheme for Registration. He also teaches at the University of Plymouth. Thank you for joining me, Stephen.
It's a pleasure.
So, Stephen, why do you think optometrists are finding the decision on whether to carry out visual field tests a bit of a dilemma right now?
I think COVID has had a big effect. And whereas in a lot of practices, visual screening of some sort probably would take place as pre-screening or pre-testing with other things as well. Since COVID, that became something that would then only be done if it was needed or required or should be done or indicated. That actually, before, you might have had a field in front of you and then it kind of ties in with symptoms or findings that you've got. Now you've actually got to think about, okay, should this patient actually have a field test done? So it has put the onus back onto the optometrist as the practitioner to decide that.
Yeah, so now you have to have a slightly higher degree of suspicion, really, don't you?
Yeah.
And in practice, when do you think optometrists should be carrying out visual field tests? Can you kind of take me through the process that you go through yourself?
Usually for those patients where a field defect might be an outcome of a risk factor, for example, you know, family history of glaucoma, I would normally do a field on a patient like that. And I suppose the other big category of patients that I would do fields on is patients presenting with headaches.
Yeah. And what are the other red flag signs or symptoms that optometrists should be aware of that might indicate there's something more sinister going on?
My main criteria would be any headaches that I couldn't explain through doing your normal clinical investigation. Headaches have got all sorts of causes that could be refractive or uncorrected or poorly corrected refraction or even, you know, BV issues. But those headaches with certain patterns to them, so where patients have headaches on waking, for example, you know, that's just so far less likely to be visually related as such that, you know, doing a neurological check, which of course the visual field is, would be appropriate in that case.
And I suppose it's about building a clinical picture, isn't it, of the patient?
Yes, that's right. I can give an example where a patient who actually, this was right in lockdown, and a patient had booked for an eye test. They had told me that they came in with some reading difficulties. And you ask about general health, of course, and this was an older gentleman on blood pressure medication and statins. And, you know, he had some kind of strange symptoms. He was saying about things being a bit jerky on the page when he was reading. And he'd had a phone consultation with the GP who suggested having a sight test. And he was 6'6 and N5 and, you know, motility seemed fine. There was no double vision. Everything looked fine. The back of the eye looked fine. I could see no causes. And he seemed to have good vision. He was wearing varifocals. There was no real change in the prescription. So I then decided, well, we'll do a field test. And we just did an ordinary screening test for that gentleman, a C40. And he did actually have a homonymous hemianopia, which was suggestive that he had had a stroke, but he wasn't having a stroke. You know, it was a stroke that potentially was the symptoms that he'd had those 4 or 5 weeks when he'd first contacted his GP.
How do you know whether to refer someone as an emergency versus urgently or routinely? And where do you refer them to?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think it's, you know, you need to decide what that patient needs. And this patient really needed a blood workup, but needed it really quite soon. So in that particular case, I did contact his GP surgery and arranged an appointment for him to go along and have a blood workup at his own doctor's surgery. I don't think an ophthalmology department would have been the right place to have sent that person because they actually needed some cardiovascular workup.
So recently you referred a patient for a suspected pituitary tumour, didn't you? So could you tell me what happened there?
This was a patient, a 15-year-old girl who'd come in with her mother. Again, it was one of those situations where they had been to the GP. The GP had suggested a sight test. It came out later that actually they'd been seeing the GP for a little while, but with no real finds as such. It was, you know, one of those situations where the patient's vision was good and the BV workup was fine, checking even, you know, near point and convergence. And again, this particular patient had a very irregular pattern as far as the headaches are concerned, which could have been eye related. And so at the end, I was thinking, well, I haven't found a reason that I could suggest from an optometric point of view why they were having headaches. So it's a standard headache. Let's have a go at doing fields as I would normally do. That would be my criteria for doing fields. The pattern almost surprised me, but, you know, looked like the start of a classic bitemporal hemianopia. Could that be, you know, a pituitary tumor or at least something that was causing compression below the chiasm? So it was a surprise. I don't think that's really happened to me in my career, actually seeing something like that that was just there.
Yeah. I remember in practice years and years ago, a patient who had come for a routine eye examination having had cataract surgery a couple of months earlier. And he had been back to the hospital department and had reported that his vision, although it was much better after the cataract surgery, just didn't feel right. And he didn't really have any particular headaches. But because I'd had pre-screening, I could see that there was some visual field loss. And I did actually refer him then to the hospital. And it was confirmed that he had a pituitary tumour and he was operated on within a couple of weeks. So that was quite fortuitous. But it just goes to show, really, sometimes patients can't always articulate what their issues are, what their symptoms are, but they just know that it's not right. And I think you've just got to have that high degree of suspicion if you can't explain their symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I would just cite that patient I mentioned earlier with the homonymous hemianopia. You know, he just kept saying he was difficulty reading. And of course, his visual acuity and his near acuity was absolutely fine. So, yeah, it was just that suspicion. It is, isn't it? It's a suspicion you get that something else isn't quite right.
It's a bit like having a spider sense.
Yeah, that's right. But it is interesting how the onus is now on the practitioner in terms of initiating that visual screening. The one that you mentioned had the pre-screening done. And generally, I find that's not the case anymore.
Stephen, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking me.
Next, I'm joined by Dr. Lindsay Rowntree. Lindsay is an assistant professor at the University of Bradford School of Optometry and Vision Science. She hosted the Docket webinar on the interpretation of visual fields. Lindsay is here to build on that and answer some of the questions that were put to her. Lindsay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Lindsay, earlier on, Stephen clearly laid out what you should be suspicious of and what could be at stake. But what are the other considerations when doing a visual field test?
Well, I think a lot of it is thinking about the patient that's in front of you. So thinking about, you know, do they need their refractive error corrected? Remember that high plus lenses are more likely to give a lens artifact. Remember, if a patient's wearing contact lenses, they can dry out during a visual field test. So the patient tends to be concentrating more. So you can end up with what looks like a field defect. It's just a dry patch on a contact lens. So either remind your patient to blink a lot or maybe get them to take it out and use a trial lens instead. Things like, what ability does the patient have? You know, is the patient struggling to sit at the field machine? Because if the patient's uncomfortable, it's going to make the test feel an awful lot longer, and they're much more likely to be unreliable if they're just physically uncomfortable. So can we do something to improve that? Or maybe we need to think about a shorter test. So even if we're getting less information, it might be more useful information than a longer test that is then unreliable as well. So I think those are probably the main things to think about.
And can you just tell me about the different types of visual field tests that we have access to? Because sometimes they're not quite sure what test they should be using in which scenario.
Yeah, so typically we can divide our visual field tests into two types. So you've got your supra threshold, which is where the machine will select a brightness level that's a little bit above threshold. So it should be well within the patient's visual ability, and it'll show all of the stimuli at that level. So it's like a pass fail. They'll either see it or they won't see it. If you suspect glaucoma, or if we're monitoring glaucoma, we would want to do a full threshold test. But if we're looking for something a bit more definite, a supra threshold is absolutely fine. And if you don't think there's anything really going on, but you want to do a field test just to sort of cover your bases, the supra threshold is usually fine as well.
So before actually looking at visual field loss, if you have done a visual field test, what is the other information that we need to take in?
So we want to look at how reliable the patient is. So our typical three reliability indices would be the fixation losses, false positives, and false negatives. And typically, we would consider a patient as being unreliable if any of these were above 20%. But it does depend a bit on which particular index you're looking at. And it does depend on how it's tested as well, because it's not tested the same in every single instrument. It doesn't always tell the full story. So, for example, your report can tell you the patient has a high percentage of fixation losses if it's plotted the blind spot incorrectly. So it's always worth monitoring the patient manually as well. So, for example, if it's telling you there's a high percentage of fixation losses, but the person conducting the field test can tell you that actually the patient was pretty good, they didn't move their eye much, you know you're not going to pay too much attention to that. Equally, if there is a known visual field defect, if there is disease present, you can get a high percentage of false negatives simply from the disease. So if you're monitoring somebody with glaucoma, for example, probably don't pay too much attention to that false negative index either. Again, we can monitor the patient manually for that. You can usually tell if the patient's attention has drifted or if they're falling asleep in the instrument or whatever it might be. If you're in doubt, repeat the test. So if the visual field defect is repeatable, you can be fairly sure it's actually there.
In the recent webinar, quite a lot of optometrists had questions about total deviation versus pattern deviation. What's the difference between the two?
So the simplest way to think about it is that the total deviation is comparing the patient to other people, whereas the pattern deviation is comparing the patient to themselves. So the total deviation will compare that patient to the normative database, so to normal patients of the same age as the patient that is in front of you. This is typically just a few hundred people, so you can get variations in the total deviation when there's not really much going on. It may just be that they're a little bit outside the realms of normal. Pattern deviation helps us to look more for localized defects, so it sort of removes any generalized loss of sensitivity. Classic one be something like cataract. If somebody's got nuclear sclerosis, the idea is that it removes the reduction in sensitivity due to that nuclear sclerosis and just leaves you with any localized defect. So you're comparing that bit of the patient's visual field to the other bit of their visual field rather than comparing them to a group of other people.
Is there anything else apart from when we're not just thinking about glaucoma? Are there other tests that we can use when we're worried about neurological defects?
I think as a general rule, we never want to be interpreting a visual field test in isolation. We always want to have a look at it in the context of every other test. So, for example, if we're thinking that there's perhaps something neurological going on, the pupil reactions can help us to isolate where in the visual pathway the problem's occurring. It's also worth remembering sort of our other types of visual field tests. So particularly if a patient's struggling a bit, if you think in neurological, something like confrontation will probably tell us what we need to know. The flip side of that is if we're thinking it's something a bit more central, maybe something like an Amsler grid is going to be better at isolating exactly what's going on and giving us more information. And the other one that I think is quite useful is the red saturation test. So typically we're thinking of things like optic neuritis when we're thinking about that. You don't always get a visual field defect with optic neuritis, but quite often if you show a patient something bright red, so like the red lid of a biro quite often works well, ask them to view it monocularly. Are they aware of that red color being duller in one eye compared to the other? That can give us an indication as well and a bit of a clue what's going on.
And how can we relate the results of a visual field test to a possible diagnosis? Can you break it down? Take me through a sort of step-by-step process of what you go through in your head when you actually look at a visual field plot.
Absolutely. And I think so much of it comes down to knowing the anatomy. When it comes to the anatomy after the eye, we can get a bit rusty at that for sure. So if you've got a visual field defect that's only in one eye and it's not in the other, you know for certain that this is happening before the optic chiasm. So you get the nasal nerve fibers crossing over at the chiasm, and that corresponds to the temporal visual field. So that's why if there's something going on at the optic chiasm, you get that classic bitemporal hemianopia. Once you go beyond that, anything that's going on in the visual pathway is going to affect both eyes, because from that point onwards, you've got fibers from both eyes at each location of the visual pathway. It's also going to be homonymous, so it's going to be on the same side. So for example, if you're seeing a right-sided visual field defect, that's going to correspond to the left side of the visual pathway. The further back in the visual pathway you go, the more congruous it becomes, so the more similar the field pattern is going to look in each eye. If you've got something like a quadrantanopia, so a quarter of the visual field being affected, that's going to be in the optic radiations. You get a separation there into Myers loop and Bohm's loop, it's called. And then if you've got anything like macular sparing, so where you've got a hemianopia, but the center of the field looks okay, well, that's going to be in the visual cortex. That's the only bit of the visual pathway you'll get hemianopia, but with macular sparing. Of course, you can get stuff happening in both eyes that is not further than the optic chiasm. So of course, the classic one would be glaucoma. You know, you get glaucoma in both eyes, but usually it's not exactly the same in both eyes. And also we're going to see that defect crossing over the vertical midline. It's much more likely to respect the horizontal midline, and that's because of the pattern of nerve fibers we see on the retina.
Thanks, Lindsay. We'll explore some more examples later on, and we'll try and put some of that into practice. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. And as we plan our content for 2023, we want to hear from you. If there is a topic you want to know more about, or if you have an interesting patient's story, it could make for the perfect podcast. Please do email us. The address is podcast@docket.info, or you can tweet us at Sound Optometry. Today, we're discussing the interpretation of visual fields with Dr. Lindsay Rowntree from the University of Bradford's School of Optometry and Vision Science. Lindsay, it's useful to think about examples of visual field loss at this point. Earlier in the podcast, Stephen talked about headaches with no refractive or binocular vision cause found. When investigating this, what should the extent of the visual field test be?
So if we're thinking about headaches and we can't find a cause in the vision for the headaches, generally speaking, the one thing you want to rule out is something nasty. You want to rule out something neurological, probably something like a brain tumor. So you probably want to test out as far as you can. It is important, though, to remember that if your instrument doesn't have that capability, most neurological problems can be detected in the central 30 degrees. So don't worry too much if your visual field instrument doesn't go out at 60 degrees. I think the thing to remember, though, is we're not really looking for subtle, is there a problem, is there not a problem? If you see something, it should be quite obvious. So a super threshold is absolutely fine. And I think the other thing as well, when we're thinking about headaches, we're not going to see problems in the eyes for every single headache. And sometimes really the best thing to do is to tell the patient to visit their GP. But we want to make sure that we've exhausted all possible avenues that we can test before we do that.
So would you advocate doing a visual field test on any patient who reports headaches, but we haven't been able to determine a visual or a binocular vision cause?
As with most things, I think it comes down to, could you be criticised if you didn't do one? If you're worried that you might have missed something, particularly if you've got those sort of slightly odd symptoms that sound vision related, but you haven't found anything, I think you would be hard pushed to justify not doing a visual field test in that circumstance.
And as you say, if you're not quite sure, you have to defend your clinical decision. So think, what would the average optometrist do? And if the average optometrist would do a field test, then you should definitely do one too.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in all honesty, it's not often we're going to find a brain tumour caused by a headache, but you don't want to miss the one that comes into your practice.
In the recent webinar, quite a lot of optometrists had questions about when a patient comes in having either recently had a stroke or may have signs of a stroke, when to do a visual field test. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think my advice on this comes from personal experience. I've tended to find that visual fields, or vision generally, gets forgotten about with stroke. So I have had cases of patients coming in, they've had a diagnosed stroke, they know they've had a stroke, they're on medication because of that. And then I put them on the field screener and they've got a homonymous hemianopia that nobody's picked up and they're still driving. So my general advice tends to be, if you've got any concerns about vision, just do a field test to be on the safe side, because you'd be surprised what people are unaware of in their visual field. And I can think of more than one example where I've had to tell people that that stroke they had 6 months ago affected their vision and they didn't know about it.
You've mentioned the quadranopias and the hemianopias as typical stroke defects. Are there any others that are fairly typical with stroke?
So a stroke is by far and away the most common cause of a visual field defect that's post-chiasmal. Apart from that, it's head trauma and brain tumours. So head trauma, of course, we can ask our patient about, you know, they hopefully would volunteer, or we can ask specifically about head trauma. Tumours, of course, that tends to be something that's a bit more gradual. So a stroke or a head trauma would take out all of the nerve fibres in one go, generally speaking, whereas something like a brain tumour would be much, much more gradual. So if you're seeing sort of a well-defined quadrantinopia or hemianopia, that often is indicating something that's happened more suddenly. Whereas if it sort of looks like it's kind of creeping in from the periphery, that can be more likely to be something like a tumour, for example. So you can't necessarily pinpoint from the field defect that this is definitely a stroke. What the pattern of the field defect tells us is where the problem's occurring in the visual pathway. And then, as I say, it's something like 70% of post-chiasmal defects are caused by strokes.
Earlier in the podcast, Stephen talked about deciding what is the most appropriate referral pathway. So with a visual field defect, how do you know where to refer to?
It all comes down to what you think's going on, really. So in the example of the stroke, and I did talk about this in the webinar, the risk to the patient isn't that their vision's going to get worse. The risk to the patient is that they're going to have another stroke if they aren't being treated appropriately. So if that's what we're suspecting, it's not the ophthalmologist they need to see. It's people to look after the stroke side of things. When we're thinking about the speed of referrals, generally, again, we're thinking about what the risk is to the patient. And most neurological things, although they're scary, they're unlikely to change in 24 hours typically. So you're probably thinking, I don't want this person to wait for over 3 months for a routine referral, but they don't necessarily need to be in A&E on the same day either. It's probably somewhere in the middle, probably in the next few weeks, that kind of thing.
So during the webinar, some optometrists were concerned about the impact on a patient's independence if they had a visual field defect. So I'm thinking about the driving, obviously. So if you were concerned about a patient's ability to drive, is it appropriate that you inform the DVLA, or should the patient inform the DVLA themselves?
Well, it's our responsibility to advise the patient, but it's the patient's responsibility to inform the DVLA. The DVLA have a list of eye conditions on the website that they expect patients to inform them of. And there's guidance from the college and from the AOP as well about that, if you're worried that a patient isn't going to take that on board. And I think generally the advice is, if the public interest outweighs our duty of confidentiality, then we should be informing the DVLA, but we should be telling the patient that we're going to do that. The College of Optometrists does also recommend that we seek advice from our professional or representative body.
Thank you. After the webinar and a podcast on this topic, it is quite clear to me that optometrists do feel that they want to know more about visual fields beyond glaucoma. There's obviously a lot of focus on glaucoma in the community, but if they want to know more about visual fields, where do you think they can go to? Can you pinpoint any learning resources?
So there's a really good resource which takes visual fields back to basics, which is published on the ZEISS website. It's the Field Analyzer Primer. The subheading is Effective Perimetry, and it's by Heil, Patella and Bengston. It's written to go alongside the Humphrey Field Analyzer, but actually I think it's quite a good sort of basic visual fields book, and it is available for free on the ZEISS website. So that's quite a good place to start. If you're thinking about sort of refreshing the anatomy of the visual pathway, and as I said, I think we can get a little bit rusty with that. The images that I have used come from samstrongvision.com. So that does fantastic illustrations on the visual pathway, and it's credit card size. So it sort of fits into your wallet or into that little pocket on your mobile phone. And it corresponds different points of the visual pathway as to the different patterns of visual field defect that you can expect. So that's a really nice tool if you just want a really quick reminder to hand, you know, if you come across something in practice.
Lindsay, thank you very much for explaining all of that to us.
Thank you very much indeed.
If you would like more information about visual fields, go to our website, dockets.info, and search for sound optometry to find the additional reading materials that Lindsay just mentioned. You can also catch up on Lindsay's hugely informative webinar on the same website. Just search for the Interpretation of Visual Fields webinar. We've also added a link in the episode description on your podcast app. Don't forget that by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice. We'll be back with another episode of Sound Optometry next month. In the meantime, we'd really appreciate it if you spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen or subscribe to the series so that every month each episode is delivered directly to you. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.